Bibles open there at Matthew chapter 5. For those of you who are visiting, we have been studying for some time on Sunday morning in these lessons, the Sermon on the Mount. And we've chosen to call the Sermon on the Mount the Gospel of the Kingdom. The idea or the concept of the kingdom, that would be the kingdom initiated by Jesus, over which he would be the king, is very prominent in this sermon. And so we've spent some weeks working our way through the point of the sermon up to the text that we're going to look at in the lesson this morning. We talked about the Beatitudes. These attitudes are character traits that would be the character of the kingdom of the citizens of the kingdom of Christ. And then we talked about the influence of the kingdom in verses 13 through 16. When Jesus said that you would be the salt of the earth, and that you would be the light of the world. In the last lesson, a couple of Sunday mornings ago, we looked at verses 17 through 20, where Jesus says, I didn't come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. He issues a warning in verse 19, therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. And then verse 20, I think, introduces this next section that we're going to begin looking at in the lesson this morning. He says, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And what follows for the rest of chapter 5, human beings, of course, have divided this sermon into chapters and verses, as all of the rest of the scriptures. But what follows in chapter 5 are a series of five contrasts. And those contrasts all are recognized by language like we see in verses 21 and 22, where Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, or something similar to that. And then his response will be, but I say to you. We suggested in the lesson a couple of Sunday mornings ago that this is very commonly interpreted to be Jesus saying, here's what the old law taught, but I'm going to show you what the new law, how the new law will be different from the law of Moses. I'm going to show you how my law will be different from the law of Christ. There are some problems, I think, inherent in taking that position. One of them being the passage that we looked at in verse 19, where Jesus warns those to whom he's preaching, don't tamper with the law of Moses, not even in the smallest particular, because if you do, you will be considered least in the kingdom of heaven. And so we have Jesus then turning around and doing what he has just warned his listeners not to do, and that is to alter or tamper with or change the law of Moses. There are also some things in this section that don't appear in the law of Moses, and we see one of them in our text, and we'll talk about here in just a few minutes. What we suggested is this. Jesus is not contrasting the law of Moses with what is going to be the law of Christ. He lived under the law of Moses. Jesus is contrasting the traditional interpretation of the law of Moses with what his real understanding of the law of Moses was. More often than not, when Jesus is quoting the law of Moses throughout the Gospels, his formula for quoting it is something like this: Moses said, or it is written. In these five sections that we're going to be looking at this morning and over the next few weeks, he doesn't say that. He doesn't say, Moses said, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to the judgment. He says, you have heard that it was said to those of old. But I say to you. And so my understanding of this section is that Jesus is talking about the interpretation of the law of Moses that they have heard. He's just said in verse 20, your righteousness has to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. And so he's telling us then here, this is what the Pharisees say about the law of Moses, but I'm going to tell you what the law of Moses really says. I'm going to tell you what the intent of the law of Moses really was. And of course, that would put Jesus in a unique position. It would put him, first of all, at odds with the teachers of the first century. That was their job. It was their occupation. It was their business. It was their livelihood. It was their life to teach the law of Moses to the Israelites. And so you have Jesus in this sermon saying, here's what they've said, but I'm telling you that in some important instances they were wrong. In some important instances, like the one that we're going to look at, they missed the point. Here's what the law of Moses really says. And so you have the traditional interpretation in our text that we've just read. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. And incidentally, and I know what some of you are thinking, I can see it in your faces. Well, the law of Moses does say that. It does. That is the sixth of the Ten Commandments. It's found in Exodus chapter 20 and a number of other places in the Old Testament. And so the law of Moses does say you shall not murder. But the law of Moses does not say whoever murders will be liable to the judgment. That understanding, that interpretation, that explanation of it was something that was attached onto it by the scribes and the Pharisees. And there are the writings and the sayings of many rabbis who existed prior to the first century and who were living in the first century, and rabbis who lived beyond the first century. Those writings have been collected and recorded. Those sayings have been collected and recorded in the Talmud, in the Mishnah in particular. And you can find statements like the last part of that very often in their writings. You shall not murder. And if you do, you are in danger of the judgment. There is some punishment coming. Some commentators think that the idea of judgment there might very well be that you're going to be brought before the Jewish courts. There were local Jewish courts. The elders in every city constituted a court for all intents and purposes. There was a high court among the Jews, and that was the Sanhedrin. I don't know if they were referring to the Sanhedrin or not. It's possible that they were, but the scribes and the Pharisees were not very closely associated with the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin consisted primarily of people who were Sadducees, or who had no particular traditional position on the Scriptures to uphold at all. There were some Pharisees who were on the council, though. And so the idea that if you commit murder, you're going to have to stand trial, you're going to have to go before the judgment, that was the interpretation of the Pharisees. Here's the contrast that Jesus gives in verse 22. That's what you heard. You've heard that it was said, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to the judgment. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. If you're using some other translation besides the English Standard Version, the word that's translated insults here, it's an Aramaic word, reka, R-A-C-A, you'll see it in the text. And the idea there is to speak disparagingly of or to, or as the English Standard Version translates, and I think correctly so, whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. If our understanding of this section of the book of Matthew, if our understanding of this section of the Sermon on the Mount is correct, then what is the problem with the traditional interpretation of the scribes and Pharisees? What is it that Jesus is trying to fix? What is it that he's trying to correct? What he's trying to correct, I believe, is this. The traditional interpretation of the scribes and the Pharisees doesn't go far enough. The idea that if a person actually reaches the point that they kill someone, then they stand in judgment. They're going to have to be held accountable for that. The law of Moses, that commandment, so much teaching in the Old Testament about the premeditated taking of another human being's life, that you've missed the real significance, you've missed the real point of that. The real point is that the attitude that leads up to the act of murder, the emotion that leads up to the act of murder, is as much a part of that teaching as the actual taking of human life itself. And what I would suggest to you is that is exactly in harmony with what the law of Moses said. A number of years ago, when I really first started thinking about this idea, And I had always interpreted and understood this section of the Sermon on the Mount to be Jesus saying, the law of Moses teaches this, but my law is going to teach something else. That I began to have some issues and problems with that is, very often the things that Jesus was saying that the law of Moses taught weren't really a part of what the law of Moses taught. And then you have this here in verses 21 through 26. You have heard that it was said, you shall not murder, and then the explanation attached onto it, that you will be liable to the judgment. And then Jesus' understanding of that being, that's not enough. That interpretation is not enough. The law of Moses teaches that if a person gets angry, there's a problem. And I want to show you that with the passage I think that we're well acquainted with, that we are familiar with. It's Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. We reference this in a lot of different contexts. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to Him. And then He lists them: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. So those are the seven things that it says that God hates. Clearly, murder is a part of that list. Hands that shed innocent blood. That is consistent with the commandment that God gave Moses, and Moses gave the Israelites on Mount Sinai: you shall not murder. But look what he goes on to say. He adds other things besides just murder: a heart that devises wicked plans, or one who sows discord among brothers. What I would suggest to you is that those are attitudes, those are dispositions that very often lead to murder. As a matter of fact, premeditated murder, now the law of Moses made arrangements for those who accidentally took someone's life. But premeditated murder involved anger on the part of one person against another person. Whatever the reason for the anger was, it doesn't really matter. But I've gotten angry with someone. A heart that devises wicked plans. The idea of premeditated murder is that I have thought this out. I've planned this. Our law, the law in the United States, clearly makes a distinction between someone who plans to kill someone else. They plan the place. They plan the time. They plan the weapon that they're going to be using. They've thought about it. They've given it forethought. And the law of the United States recognizes and understands that that person is absolutely and completely and totally accountable for the loss of human life. We call that first degree murder, I think, most of the time. Maybe some exceptions to that. But it is the attitude that precedes the act that our law considers to be important. And so vehicular homicide, for example, sometimes, very tragically, a person might lose control of a car, or somebody might pull out in front of you and you take their life. The law considers that to be the taking of life, but what if you'd been drinking before you got behind the wheel and you took somebody else's life? The law considers that to be different. You knew what you were doing when you took the drink. You knew that you'd been drinking when you got behind the wheel. And so that is considered to be more serious in our law. There is some forethought behind it. There's a thinking process behind it. And what I would suggest to you is that this section in Proverbs chapter 6, I think, says exactly what Jesus says in our text in Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 26. Listen, you've heard the Pharisees say, if you kill somebody, you're going to stand before judgment. They've missed the point. It's more than just the taking of life. It is the attitude that leads up to the taking of human life. So God not only hates hands that shed innocent blood, He hates the heart that devises wicked plans that might very well lead to the taking of human life. He hates one who sows discord among brothers. Have you ever wondered why somebody would do that? What would motivate someone in a local church? What would motivate a Christian to try to stir up strife, to try to stir up controversy? And what I would suggest, there may be a number of things involved, but what I would suggest to you is that foundationally, at least one of the things that has to almost always be involved when someone is plotting and planning, I'm going to divide this church, I'm going to divide those people, is anger in their hearts in the direction of one or more of those people who are involved. And God hates that, Solomon said. One who sows discord among brethren. I think it's significant. That's a different sermon. But I think it's significant that in the same list where God says, I hate murder, God says, I hate the one, And incidentally, let's not sugarcoat this. God doesn't say, I hate the act, but I love the person. God says, I hate the one who sows discord among brethren. How serious is it to have animosity in our hearts toward another person to the point that we would try to destroy them? Maybe destroy their relationship with other brethren. Maybe to try to destroy their reputation in an area or in a place. And if we can't get that done, maybe to the point where we're even ready to take their lives. That's how strongly motivated we are by anger. And so I think what Jesus is doing in this section of the Sermon on the Mount is he's pointing back to the original intention of the law of Moses. When God said to Moses, tell the Israelites, you shall not murder, he wasn't just saying, you need to be careful that you don't, in a premeditated way, take some other human being's life. What he's saying is, and again, other Old Testament scriptures I think make this abundantly clear, you need to be warning people that even the attitudes that would lead up to or could lead up to the premeditated taking of human life, murder, is something that is forbidden by God. Look at Psalm 37 and verse 8, for example. I mean, is it true that the law of Moses just said it's wrong to murder, but the law of Christ says don't even be angry with your brother? Well, again, remember that when Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount, the law of Christ was not in force. It wasn't in effect. Jesus was still living under the law of Moses. But in point of fact, it's not true that the law of Moses only taught that it was wrong to murder. And the law of Christ teaches that it's wrong to just be angry. The law of Moses taught that it was wrong to be angry too. And so David says in the 37th Psalm, refrain from anger and forsake wrath. That's exactly the warning that Jesus issued in Matthew chapter 5. And so what Jesus is saying is, you've been listening to the Pharisees. They give you this traditional interpretation that the only time you're in danger of standing before the judgment is when you actually take someone's life. Jesus says that was never the only intention of the law of Moses. The law of Moses taught that it was extremely important that we understand that anger, wrath, is the emotion that leads people to mistreat other people and ultimately leads people to commit murder. You see something very similar in Galatians chapter 5. This is a part of what Paul calls in Galatians chapter 5, starting in verse 19, the works of the flesh. And among the works of the flesh are fits of anger. Well, look at Psalm 37. Refrain from anger. Rivalries, dissensions, divisions. Forsake wrath in Psalm 37. Really, in this particular case, there's no significant difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ. Under the law of Moses, it was wrong to plot and plan to take another human being's life. Under the law of Christ, it is wrong to plot and plan to take another person's life. Under the law of Moses, it was wrong to get so angry with a brother that you would plot to do them harm in some way or another. That's exactly the way it is in the law of Christ. And so we have this in Ephesians chapter 4. And verse 31, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Again, that's not any significantly different than what we saw in Psalm 6. The things God hated under the law of Moses, He continues to hate. Those kinds of things that lead us to mistreat and to abuse other people, and especially to abuse other people in the close relationships that we have with brothers. Now, how serious is this? That we need to be careful that we understand. Jesus' point, we need to be extremely careful that we understand that when God said to Moses on Mount Sinai, you shall not murder, He was saying more than just don't take somebody's life. What He was saying was don't have anger and wrath and malice in your heart toward a brother that would lead you even to doing something like that. You need to put those things away. Here's how serious it is. Jesus said, he's two things here in verses 24 through 26. The first one is this. If my attitude toward my brethren isn't right, it can have an impact on my worship. And how serious a problem is it to be angry with a brother? And incidentally, going back to verse 22, some people see a progression in verse 22. Whoever is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Okay, then you take it up, you kick it up a notch. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And then you kick it up another notch. Whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. That's a possible understanding of that. I think it's more likely that it's just Jesus finding three ways to say the same thing. We do that for the sake of emphasis many times in our writing, in our speech. We try to, and that technique, incidentally, is very prominent in the Scriptures too. That just for the sake of emphasis, he repeats it in different words three different times. I don't think there's fundamentally, you know, and some commentaries will try to say, well, judgment, that would be the local courts, and the council, that would be the Sanhedrin, and the hell of fire, that would be, you know, the end of life, and God is consigning you to eternal torment. Again, maybe there's something to that. I don't know that I see that. I think he's just trying to emphasize that the law of Moses condemns or forbids our getting so angry with another person that we contemplate and plan and perhaps even carry out the taking of another human being's life. How serious is it? Well, first of all, verses 23 and 24. So if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come offer your gift. How important is it under the law of Moses, under the law of Christ, under our relationship with God, how important is it that I try to the best of my ability not to have these conflicts, not to have these problems, not to have these hard feelings with other brethren? It can have an impact on your worship, Jesus said. And so you would be better off. You think we know what God thinks about worship. We know how important worship is. For Jesus to say, you would be better off setting worship aside temporarily and go and fix things with your brother, and then come and offer worship that would be acceptable worship to God. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever attended a worship service maybe shortly after you have just had a big argument, a big fight with somebody? Maybe a big disagreement at work? Maybe somebody cut you off in traffic on the way here. That never happens in Bowling Green, but you know it does. There are some bad drivers some other places, and so maybe and so you walk in the building and you're still just steaming about the way that you know that you were treated on the road, or you know somebody said something to you. Your team lost a big game, and you're really angry because your team was the better team, and clearly the officials stole the game from you, and so you're just so angry about it. And you find yourself sitting in a worship but having a hard time focusing on why you're there because your mind keeps going back to what made you angry. I mean, honestly, brethren, all of us have been in that position, have we not? Where it becomes difficult to worship because of anger, because of wrath, because of bitterness. I mean, how serious is it, Peter? We're not going to turn there. But in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, Paul instructs husbands to dwell with their wives according to understanding, treating them, living with them, understanding that they are the weaker vessel. And he says the reason is so that your prayers be not hindered. And so you're married and there's a conflict between you and your spouse, and that will happen from time to time. The degree of seriousness will vary from situation to situation, but you're frustrated with your husband. You're angry with your wife. And Peter says it's hard to pray when you feel like that. Your prayers are going to be hindered. And so husbands, dwell with your wives according to understanding. That's what Jesus is saying here. The problem with the Pharisees' traditional interpretation of the sixth commandment is they didn't take it far enough. God intended much more than just the actual literal taking of human life. He intended for His people to understand and recognize that they needed to deal with and they needed to put away the attitudes that actually would lead to the taking of a human life. And again, it's almost always anger. As a matter of fact, I've been thinking for the last couple of weeks about how to illustrate that. I've been trying to think of some exceptions. I can't. Maybe you can come up with some, and you can share those with me later. And if they're good, I'll pay attention to them. If they're not, I'll ignore them. But you can share them with me anyway. But it's difficult for me to conceive of a murder being committed without anger being involved in the equation someplace before the murder takes place. It's just hard to imagine that taking place. You know, there's this thing called road rage. And people have actually been killed because someone did something to them in traffic, and it made them what? Made them angry. It made them angry. A husband kills a wife. A wife kills a husband. A child kills a parent, or a parent kills a child. A student kills a teacher. And unless there are mental issues involved, which the law takes into consideration, it just seems to me as though you can always, if you dig back far enough, you can always trace that to its roots, and the roots are somebody got mad. Somebody got angry. Have you ever been so mad at someone, usually this is sibling related, that you would even say, I could just kill you? With no intention in your heart to ever do that, but we're so angry that we say it. We associate in our mind that conclusion, that end, that we are so self-centered that when something doesn't go to suit us and it makes us angry, it leads us to want to do something to retaliate, something to try to get even, something to try to make the person who's made us angry feel bad. And so we end up in that situation. Again, some people end up in that situation actually getting to the point where they take someone's life. And what happens when you take someone's life? Well, look what Jesus says secondly. Come to terms quickly with your accuser. While you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. And Jesus said, truly I say to you, you will never get out until you've paid the last penny. Do you suppose that there are any prisoners locked up in the prisons in the state of Kentucky? I know that one of the men's prisons is over in western Kentucky. I don't know where all of the prisons are, the women's prisons and the minimum security. I mean, I don't know where all those places are in Kentucky. But do you think it's likely that there are people who are locked up in those places because they got angry about something and did something that caused them ultimately to lose their freedom? That has to be the point that Jesus is making here. You get into a dispute with somebody, and it's going to end up in court. Well, you go back to verse 22, whoever is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. That's got to be talking about the courts. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. Whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. Anger has consequences. And listen, Jesus said, those consequences can be serious. You may not ever get to the point where you actually take someone's life, but it could cost you your freedom. If you lose control of your temper, it could cost you your relationship with God and worship. You'd be better off to set worship aside and go fix things with your brother first, and then come back and worship God in spirit and in truth. You lose control of your temper, Jesus said, and you might very well lose your freedom. I suspect, I was being a little sarcastic a few moments ago, I suspect the prisons of the state of Kentucky, the jails in the state of Kentucky, are absolutely filled to overflowing with people who are there because they got angry and they said or did something that ended up costing them their freedom. And so Jesus says this is a serious, serious issue. The law of Moses, you've been told by the Pharisees that really the only thing you have to worry about is actually taking somebody's life. Jesus said the law of Moses, really the intention of the law of Moses, the teaching of the law of Moses is you need to be concerned about the attitudes that would lead you up to the taking of human life. And that's certainly true in the kingdom of Christ as well. We looked at Galatians 5, the things that were a part of the works of the flesh. We looked at Ephesians 4, 31 and 32, putting away all wrath and anger and clamor and bitterness. We understand that it's not just the actual taking of human life. God doesn't want us to be angry with people. And here's why, and the lesson will be yours. I felt like it was important to add this point, and really I've just added it in the last couple of days. that there is a place for anger. There is a place for anger. And we see that in the life of Jesus. In John chapter 2, I don't have that listed on the list I should have, but in John chapter 2, at the very beginning of his personal ministry, according to John, when he starts his teaching ministry, the first time that he goes to Jerusalem for the Passover, he goes up into the temple and he sees the money changers' tables there, and it makes him angry. And he overturns the tables. Matthew then records that a week before he died, when he enters Jerusalem at what we've come to call the triumphant entry, the triumphal entry, that when he entered Jerusalem and he went into the temple at the beginning of the Passover feast, which would have been the fourth of the Passovers that he attended during the period of time that he was teaching and training his apostles, and he goes into the temple and the tables are there again, and he gets angry and he throws the tables over and he drives the money changers out of the temple. And so Jesus got angry. I don't have time this morning to look at all of the context of Mark chapter 3. But in Mark chapter 3, Jesus is given the opportunity to heal a person on the Sabbath day. And the Pharisees are watching to see if he'll do it, because they want to accuse him. And Mark says Jesus knew their hearts, and I think it's verse 5 of Mark chapter 3, it made him angry. I mean, that's the term that Mark uses. He knew their hearts and it made him angry. There are many examples in the Old Testament of God being angry. There is a place for anger, but here's the problem. So if there's a place for anger, why would Jesus warn us about getting angry? Why would he warn us? You need to keep your temper under control. It's this, brethren, I think at least it's this. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is not saying all anger is wrong. Jesus is not warning that it is always wrong to get angry. He's warning against a certain kind of anger. In none of these cases where Jesus got angry was his personal ego involved. Jesus didn't drive the money changers out because it made him look bad. Jesus didn't get angry at the scribes and Pharisees about healing that man on the Sabbath day because it insulted his ego. They don't think I can do it. They don't think I will do it. Well, I'll show them. Every time Jesus got angry, it was righteous anger. He got angry because righteousness was challenged. Righteousness was insulted. God was insulted. And that provoked anger. The anger that Jesus warns about in the Sermon on the Mount involves ego. It involves personal relationships, personal animosity. It occurs to me, and this is the editorial part of the lesson. It occurs to me that more often than not, way more often than not, when I get angry, it has everything to do with me and nothing to do with God. And I would ask, am I alone in that? Most of the time when I get angry because I'm thinking about me. I was offended. I was cut off. I was interrupted. I was treated rudely. That little I keeps, that ego keeps popping up over and over again. And it really embarrasses me, brethren, when I examine my life and compare my life to Jesus' life. It embarrasses me how seldom I get angered because of righteousness. That's sad, I think, for me. The kind of things that made Jesus mad don't always make me mad. They ought to. When I hear someone taking God's name in vain, that ought to make me mad. It ought to make me good and angry. When I hear someone, and especially when I hear someone who professes to be a Christian, say, and I'll just use the initials, OMG, or even when I see those initials in emails and tweets and places on the internet, that ought to make me angry. Because that person is taking God's name in vain. When I am watching a movie, watching a television program, and immorality is blatant, sexual immorality, filthy language, immodest dress, that ought to make me mad. And I've told you all this story before of taking a visiting gospel preacher and his wife. They wanted to see the Western campus. And so I was going to proudly show them the Western campus. And we'd been someplace for lunch. And after lunch, I went up to the type. We did this in the car. I wasn't going to walk up the hill myself, let alone ask a visiting preacher to walk up the hill, or his wife. So we started at the top and we started driving down. We got about halfway down the hill and the preacher's wife was sitting in the back seat and she leaned up and said, "Gary, can we just go home?" And so I turned there before you get to Diddle Arena and went back out to the main road and we just went home. And I didn't know till later, I thought maybe she wasn't feeling well. I didn't know till later that she was just so frustrated at what the kids were wearing. Walking up and down the hill on campus. What they weren't wearing would be a better way to say that. Walking up and down the hill on campus. And it made her angry. And she would rather not have seen the rest of campus than to have to keep looking at that immodesty just being thrown in her face. And I have to tell you something, brethren, when I learned that, that made me feel tiny and ashamed. Because I drive through that campus all the time. And I'm not trying to excuse myself, but I wonder if what happens is we don't see it so much, we don't hear it so much that we get numb to it. Do you think maybe our consciences just kind of get glazed over? That we see it so much. Would to God that we had more anger. The right kind of anger. That we could learn as God's people to be angry at the things that make Him angry. So all anger is not forbidden by God. But any anger that is an expression of my selfishness is dangerous. As a matter of fact, if you go back to Proverbs chapter 6, it's something that is hated by God. That's the first of the contrasts. We said there are five of them. Lord willing, next Sunday morning we'll pick it up in verse 27. These contrasts continue on down through the end of the chapter. And we'll look at what they had heard said, and then we'll look at Jesus' explanation for each one of these things. But that's the lesson for this morning. Learning to control our temper, learning to control our anger is such an important part of being in a right relationship with God. And I would suggest to you that it's always been an important part of being in a right relationship with God. Abel died because Cain got mad. Even in the patriarchal age, anger led to other more serious consequences. Now, take out your songbooks if you would. It is the supplementary songbook and open it to number 97. That's the song that Brother Keister has suggested that we sing as a song of encouragement or invitation. The lesson really hasn't been designed to teach anyone who's here who might need to obey the gospel what they need to do. This lesson has been mostly for those of us who are Christians to think about our relationship with God and the kinds of things that happen to us in the world that might jeopardize that relationship. But if you're here and you're not a Christian and you know you need to become one and you know what you need to do, what a great opportunity to just stand up in front of this group of people and confess your faith in Christ. Say, "I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Repent of your sins." And then one of us would be thrilled to go down into the water with you and baptize you into Christ for the remission of sins. If you're subject to God's invitation and there is anything that we can do to assist you this morning, please step out into the aisle, come down to one of these front seats, and let us help you right now. While we stand and sing, we invite you to come.
Amen.